This is EdTech Weekly, the show that keeps you informed of the EdTech news of the week. Sounds like we named it pretty well. I'm your host, Ricky Zager, and with me, as always, Matt Harrison, our resident tech guru. Welcome, Matt.
Hello.
Always an inspired welcome from you, Matt. I love it.
I said hello.
I said good day, sir. Let's start off by mentioning what I think is an unstoppable force. As of this recording, I can say that our show has been listened to in 5 different states. That's right, count them, 5 different states. Matt, is there anything that can hold us back?
No, other than an EMP, but no.
No, now you've instilled fear in my heart now. I don't want any EMPs. That's bad. I've got a lot of digital media, and I don't want it to be lost. Oh, well. I am still anxiously awaiting our first listener email. Matt, we haven't gotten one of those yet. From either our spouses or family members, anything. A couple of episodes ago, we had a listener in Alabama, and we said, if you email us at edtechweekly@gmail.com, we will give you an unbelievable prize, a signed copy of artwork from the show. Matt, we haven't gotten any emails from the person in Alabama. Should we extend this out to anyone at all who emails us?
I'm doubling down, Alabama. You're the only hope.
Well, I don't know if there are only hope. I think we should extend this out to everyone. And I tell you what, I also have one more. I'm going to ante up a little bit here. I have a $15 Google Play Store card. It was originally purchased to give to you, Matt, as a thank you for helping me out with the show. But you know what? I think our listener deserves it more.
Hopefully they have an Android then.
Right now, all I'm offering is the Google Play. And so if they're not into Android, then they need to figure out a way to get involved, and at least in the Google Play Music or something. I don't know. So anyway, we'd love to get an email to prove that the analytics in Podbean are not a sham, that it's true. We do actually have at least a couple listeners. It says that we've had 50-something listens. So somebody out there, email us at edtechweekly@gmail.com. Just let us know you're listening. And again, there is a $15 Google Play Store gift card on the line, unless I decide to give it to Matt. But I think I'll give it to you. Let's get started with the EdTech News of the Week, Matt. TechnologyReview.com reports that security researchers have developed an automated system for detecting Android apps that secretly connect to ad sites and user tracking sites. Maybe we should rethink the Google Play Store thing here. Essentially, a couple of guys took 2,000 Android apps and ran them through their own server. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Matt, but this is what I got out of the story. So that they could track how many URLs these apps connected to. Surprise, around 250,000. That's right. Many of which were ad tracking sites. Most notably, and maybe confusing, a music volume equalizer app that connected to 2,000 distinct URLs. Matt, what up with that?
Well, apps themselves, there are these great things that we click on and they're free and nobody pays attention and hits the yes, I want this as soon as possible button, and we don't understand the ramifications that come with that. It is not surprising in any way, shape, or form, and it's scary.
Yeah, it's a little bit scary. Now, this is going to be a part of our tip of the week, so we're going to discuss this a little bit more later. The app that they created is called No Such App, short for NSA. Matt, do you think that was planned at all?
I don't know. I don't see any connection there. Is NSA meant for anything else? It just seems like they just threw darts at a board and had N, S, and A around, and they had to come up with something.
They could have called it Edward Snowden or something. I don't know, but I guess you're right. It was probably just random that it came out to be NSA.
Edward Snowden, I mean, he's best known for his work as the original Hulk, the early 2000 film, right?
Yes, I believe that's Ed Norton.
Ah, there we are.
It's easily confused. Our next story, Matt, comes from CNET. According to them, desktops are not dead. I repeat, they are not dead. Matt, should we not email our condolence card to the desktop computer manufacturers just yet? Do you see any life in any of these models?
I love these types of articles because they come out around the same time and someone writes, the desktop is dead, and somebody else writes, the desktop is alive, and it just reminds me of death to the desktop, long live the desktop. There's so much jargon that goes out with these. The models that they actually talk about in this, I think that they are great-looking models. for me personally, I would rather see a standard size desktop, one that you actually could swap things in and out of very easily. But for something like this, I mean, they actually look very nice and are appealing to students or anyone who has a house.
Yeah, Matt, one of them looks so nice that it looks suspiciously like an iMac. Do we think patent attorneys are getting ready to go here?
I think they'd go at just about anything, so.
Good point, yes. They pretty much go at the drop of a hat. No worries there. You know, for schools, shouldn't a desktop be the most efficient way to spend money? It sounded like you alluded to that.
Yeah, for me, I think that we need to be spending more time actually thinking about deployment and long-time operations of these machines. I mean, when I was in high school, when I was a senior, we had Dell desktops that had been 4 years old by the time I got there. How many laptops or tablet deployments can a school, you know, do where, you know, it's around for 4 years and it's still operational?
You're 100% right. I mean, the iPad 2s, I'm not sure, but I think that was 2 years ago, the iPad 2s. And those are already not running the next version of iOS, I believe. And they're already a little slow and a little clunky. And that's only been 2 years. And that would be a max if you got them when they first came out. So, yeah, there's too many things inside of, they try to make touchscreens, even whether they're all-in-ones or whether they're laptops, that they try to make them small so that they're a little more either appealing size-wise or also maybe, you know, battery life, depending on what you're looking at. And they don't really easily swap out anything. So, I mean, to me, monitors seem to last a while. I don't know that we're getting away from an HDMI standard anytime soon. And you can still use VGA or the, what's the other connector, Matt, that I'm struggling to think?
DVI.
The DVI connection. So those to me can last a long time, the monitors. And, you know, if you're just upgrading towers and or maybe even just upgrading some of the internal parts in the towers, I mean, that could be even a part of either a science class or a computer science class, you know, refurb or, you know, upping some of the memory or other features in a desktop. I mean, what do you think about that for a strategy for schools? Does that sound like something you think would work?
I think it's a much more cost-effective way of doing it. Not only that, but you're actually able to get students involved with these. And it costs a whole heck of a lot less. I mean, if you have a computer lab or, you know, everybody has access to computers in different, you know, classrooms and stuff like that, you're not giving the student a piece of hardware and expecting that they're going to take care of it. You see what they do when they give them bags of sugar, you know, for the parent test thing. I mean, half of them end up on the ground broken open. So,
well, that's a lovely image. But you're right. I mean, basically what we try to do or what we should be trying to do here is facilitate more students being involved in this process. And I think you're right in that regard. If we allow them to be a part of kind of keeping these computers ready to go, we're teaching them some skills they can use and getting them maybe interested in doing something after school as well, but also helping our schools maintain the appropriate level of tech that, you know, can be sustainable. So I think you make some good points there. Our next story, CNET reports that Steve Wozniak thinks we have made machines too important in all aspects of our lives, but he also singles out education as an area that we seem to be trying to throw tech at problems, and it's just not solving them. Is the Woz onto something here, Matt?
I would say that he is. I mean, he's sort of always been somewhat contrarian when it comes to a lot of things and tries to look at things from different angles. I would probably agree with him on this. I mean, you've worked more on deployment and actually talking about hardware and, you know, deploying it into schools and getting them into students' hands. Is the same amount of energy and time and money being spent towards how you're effectively going to be using them? Are we coming up with new ways, you know, instead of the new tablet being the thing that we write our papers on, are we also talking about how to use the new programs, you know, effectively so the student can use it? And maybe the technology doesn't need to be the focus of it. It just needs to be a tool used to help, you know, aid and facilitate education.
Yeah, I think, you know, from my experience in education, I've seen all sides of that. And I feel like I see a little too much where we are just kind of going, oh, this is kind of the new thing or the cool thing or the wow factor, so to speak. And we're pushing that forward without really considering how is this helping the education process overall? What is this doing to actually help the students? Yeah, you can be in a product demo and they can go, look at what you can do with this and look at what your students can do with this. And you can get kind of caught up in that and go, oh, that's great, that's great. The practice of it isn't so easy to you know, replicate. And it also depends on other systems that your district or schools are using. To me, I think he's right when in terms of, you know, a lot of times it looks like we do just throw technology and say, hey, this is going to fix things, because kids like technology and technology is what's happening now. It's all changing. So if we just get the newest, coolest thing, they're going to be interested. And interest wears out on anything new and cool. It doesn't matter. It's just like when I go get a new iPhone, it's so cool the first, you know, week or so, and then it's like, it's just a phone again. And I think that's the same thing with technology in schools. You know, we throw a lot of money at something, but at the end of the day, it's just a piece of technology, or like, as you said, a tool. So I think he's onto something here. Do you find it shocking that someone who, you know, helped found Apple computers would have this type of view of technology? Or do you think this maybe comes, you know, as a part of his personality, or is it expected with somebody who works with technology so much to maybe be a little cynical?
I think it's all three.
All three.
Yeah. I think it's expected for somebody who comes from his background. He's always been that type of person who's somewhat been contrarian about it. And it is somewhat surprising coming from someone, you know, in that sector. But I think that's what makes him one of the great sage people in this discussion, is finding ways in which we can focus. The focus shouldn't be on the latest gadget. It's how the gadget should be implemented and fixing problems.
And you know what I found interesting, and I didn't really do any back check on this, so I could be off here, but the picture that they used for the story, now this could be an old picture, but I was assuming that it was taken, you know, at the time he was doing this lecture that they were talking about. But it appears that he's got like an iPhone 4S or 4, you know, it doesn't seem like one of the newer phones, which is almost incredible to me to believe.
Oh, this is a way older photo. He also did a whole thing where he dropped Apple for a little while and worked on Android. I mean, he likes technology. He likes learning it and getting involved in it. So,
okay.
Yeah, it's just an older picture.
Okay, good. But even so, I have noticed that people who are really into tech sometimes are sometimes a little behind, you know, the curve of the newest device, and I always question that. And I think it may be a part of what you said before, where they're so involved in it that they understand that, you know, they know what's coming next, maybe even, so they're not that worried about that particular iteration. All right, our final story is from Wired.com. They report about Alt School, a school that Silicon Valley believes can reform education, transform education. From a story about tech not saving our schools and possibly being an issue, to one about a different mindset that they believe just might actually solve the problem of schools here. Essentially, Alt School believes it's solving education problems by removing bells, classes, the normal traditional classroom atmosphere that you see in schools now. They have instructors who are personalizing learning. They use something called cards that they give tasks to the students to complete, and they kind of tailor those to the students. The founder of this school, who is Max Ventilla, is that right, Mac, or is it Ventilla? I don't want to be pronouncing names incorrectly. I've done that before.
Actually, this one, I have no idea.
Okay, good. Well, that makes me feel better. We'll go with Ventilla. He was once the head of personalization at Google, and he is now trying to narrow the gap in education, but he's trying to narrow it between the people who are programming the learning management system and those who are using it, the teachers and the students. These are all interesting concepts. Would this have been a school that you think you would have excelled at, Matt?
Probably not. I mean, honestly, I think this concept is very much outside of what maybe our parents would have been comfortable with, you know, back in the day. And my love for technology just came from me being able to play with it outside of it. I studied English Lit because I still love Lit more than anything else. So it's an interesting concept, and I love the idea, and I love the idea of grabbing students at a really young age that are really interested in this, and then putting them into a situation that fosters their growth. But to me, it's just another specialized school, and I think there's a lot you can learn from it. I mean, one of the things I highlighted in the article is talking about the difference is, Alt School is not just building apps or building schools, it's doing both. It's basically just looking at this issue of schools in a whole different way and coming up with their own spin on it. And I think it's perfectly acceptable for us to have hundreds of thousands of different schools out there that break the mold, where we're not centering everything around, you know, just test taking and stuff like that. There's so many practical applications of everyday students and everything that they could be learning on a day-to-day basis that we can drill down and then focus in on those things. And we shouldn't be taking away from it. We should be fostering growth like that.
Yeah. And you're right on here with, there's parts of this that are definitely things that are going to kind of push the conversation about changes in education system. But I would not have done well with this. And I know, coming from experience when I started teaching with dropout prevention, that we had some schools that some of them left to go to where it was like all online, and they sat in a room and nobody was on them, and, you know, nobody was kind of pushing them to succeed. And none of my students that went there passed, you know, none of them graduated from that program. Some of them came back to a more traditional school and made it. But, you know, again, I don't think this is a one size fits all problem that you're going to come up with something here that's going to change it. But I do find a few things interesting. It goes back to a single room schoolhouse concept. I think that sort of maybe camaraderie and that sort of everyone's in the same location is a good concept. And also, I mean, you know, why do we have bell schedules every 50 minutes? I mean, there's a lot of research that's been behind how long students should be in school in each class and how long their attention span is. But I think this does push that conversation to what is important, what can we change that might help schools work a little bit better? Do you think it's important that this school succeeds? Is that important at all in this discussion?
I think it's important that it succeeds in the fact that children are going to be involved in it. But you could have 1,000 of this same type of concept and X percentage of them are actually going to succeed. It's just, in my mind, just great and refreshing to hear. It's pushing against the norm of what we think school should be. So I think it being part of the conversation is probably the most important part, second only to the students themselves getting something out of it.
Yeah, and I think the personalization front on this slant, I should say, on this is where I think this school has some merit. They seem to actually be encouraging teachers to really get into the, you know, either particulars of the student that they like or don't like or are good or aren't good at, and sort of creating a curriculum that's designed more for them. And I think that even in our schools right now, if teachers had more time to be able to do that, the problem is they've got, you know, most of them have, you know, in high schools, 150 students or so throughout the day. So not really the easiest thing to do. If you have a single schoolroom with 15 kids, you know, that might be a much easier thing to accomplish. Still not easy, but easier. Let's move on to the tip of the week. And we talked about this in our first story. And I'm definitely going to let you talk about this a bit, Matt, because I know this kind of is a little more in your wheelhouse here. But the story where we're talking about where apps are communicating without users' knowledge to a variety of URLs, you know, this is definitely more of an issue in the Android ecosphere. Apple's a little more stringent. I'm sure there are still things that can get through with them as well. But what can you speak to about permissions of apps and what the process is that could help people kind of avoid some of these that are connecting into these kind of suspicious URLs?
Well, I brought this up when we were going over the show notes. This was something I wanted to talk about just because it's infuriating for me when I download an app and then I hit, okay, install, and then it gives me a laundry list of all the things that it wants to do. And I'm like, well, all you're doing is telling me a sports score. I don't know why you have to know all this stuff. So yeah. It made me think back to, you know, several years ago, I had a Nexus. No, I didn't even have a Nexus. I had a Motorola Atrix 1. And when it first came out, you know, we didn't have the flashlight app. We didn't have so many of these other things. And with Android, there are so many different phones that are out there. There's really no, unless you have a pure version of Android, there are so many different things out there that do and do not come with it. So you had this one great app. I use quote great in quotations. You can't see this. This is a terrible medium for, you know, visual things. But you install the app and it's basically a flashlight. So it's that thing we all take advantage, you know, we use quite a bit. I mean, I know with Apple, you guys have it. And with my Nexus, I have it. That's automatically built in. Wake up at 2:30 in the morning, you know, have to let the dog out. You know, you turn the flashlight on, you walk so you make sure you don't step on anything. This app that came out like 6-7 years ago was the top downloaded Android app. But it wanted to know everything. It wanted email history, it wanted contacts, it wanted GPS, it wanted barometer. I mean, if it could have taken your blood, it would have done so. And it was a
That's what the Apple Watch is for, right?
Yes, exactly. But
yeah, I think about that, and there's definitely a lot of apps, even on the iOS platform, that asks for contacts. I'm like, you don't need to know my contacts. Stop it. You're just trying. I mean, and it's like, are they going to be getting emails from this? It's just, I don't get why they need my contacts for so many things.
Yeah. Well, and it goes back to what we talked about last week with data and how important it is, and you know how we could easily lose it, but also data as an intrinsic valuable thing. I mean, look at the story up top that we talked about. You know, why is it there's 250 URLs that they're going to so they can track stuff and get advertising data? It's because they sell the data to somebody else, and somebody makes decisions on how to target us, and that's what they do. You log into Facebook right now, and if you searched in Google in the past, you know, 2 weeks for, let's say, a cricket bat, in Facebook, you're going to see ads for cricket bats. I mean, it's
I've seen that directly happen multiple times, especially in the last maybe 6 months, more so than ever. If I search for something on Google, I go to Facebook and I'm getting an ad right in my face about it. I'm like, wait, that's kind of crazy. But is there a protocol that somebody can go through? I mean, I know education specifically, a lot of times they have those, but as a teacher, if they have an Android device and they're concerned with security, is there a protocol? Like, if we see an app that we want, and is there something we say, hey, if it wants contact data, do we just say, sorry, I'm going to have to find another app? I mean, is that what we suggest in this situation?
Yes, absolutely. I did it for a long time. I had my Nexus 6 and the ESPN app didn't work because that's the one I was used to. It doesn't bother me with a bunch of stuff. And I probably downloaded and almost installed probably close to a dozen of them and just got frustrated. I'm like, why do you need to know all this stuff about me? And just got rid of it. I finally found an Arsenal soccer one that asked me for, you know, just the ability to display information and get information from the internet. That's it. That's it.
Well, plus you don't really want many people to know you're a Minnesota Vikings fan. So that's probably one of your concerns with that, right?
Well, you know, that's what like Bengals fans really like to pile on to other teams.
Whoa. Slow down. Bengals have been in the playoffs the last few years. I will just mention that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I can't. No, there's nothing else you guys have been in the news about either.
All right, let's move on to some. So basically what we're saying here is if it's asking you for contacts or something that's suspicious, especially in the Android app ecosphere, you can find another app and keep trying apps. It may be a bit of a pain, but I think that's sort of what they go for. They think it's so easy to just say, okay, accept. Most people are just going to do it. So if you're really concerned about your security and making sure that your data is not being tracked and they're not using it to sell, whatever the case may be, you need to just say no, don't install it, find another app. Another suggestion that I thought might be, you know, appropriate is if it's an app that's designed by a larger company, I mean, if it's like an Adobe app or something like that, I'm a little more loose about letting them have my data. And maybe that's a bad idea too. I don't know. I expect that they're going to be more responsible with it, but I guess we've seen in the news some even recently that may not be the case.
I think that they tend to be, and they are also accountable. So if Adobe does get hacked and all of your information gets sent out, there's a protocol that they have to go through. I had this discussion last night. You can name the four big advertising places that are like when you go to Google, you know that you're going to have Google tracking, you know, X, Y, and Z. There's going to be about four big players no matter where you go. What about the other tens of thousands? You know, you're on Facebook. Facebook may be grabbing your data and tracing it, but use a program that tells you where all of these ad blocks are coming from, and just try to find out who they are. I mean, it's next to impossible. Those are the ones we need to be worried about, is the ones that are under the radar. Nobody knows about them. Nobody talks about them.
Yeah, and that story that we talked about to open the show, I think, talks about that. Like, you know, it was kind of stunning to think that 2,000 apps could be asking to hit 250,000 URLs. I mean, it's definitely, and like I said, you can download that app. I believe it's available now, the NSA app, and you can find out what your apps are connecting to, I believe, with that app. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Well, that's a great tip, Matt, and I appreciate your expertise in that area. This concludes another episode of EdTech Weekly. Thanks for joining us. Matt, thanks as always for being here. If you want to reach me, again, edtechweekly@gmail.com. Email the show. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, what you'd like us to talk about, and, you know, have a chance at that $15 Google Play Store app gift card so that you can download some, you know, precarious apps that are going to give your information to people you're unsure of. Follow me at 4TechTeachers, the number 4TechTeachers on Twitter, and we'll see you next time on EdTech Weekly.
Au revoir.